Okay. The first case is State versus Mann. Are the parties ready?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, please proceed.
Can I reserve 1 minute for rebuttal, please?
1 minute it is. And please remember that the microphones don't amplify your voice. They just go into a recording device.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Evan Fuller, and I am the attorney for the appellant, Michael Mann. I was informed this morning that my co-counsel, Mr. Daniel Tiamori, will not be able to make oral arguments today, so I will be the only counsel for the appellant.
Very well.
There were numerous errors that occurred at the trial. As I will explain, not only was Mr. Mann deprived of his constitutional right to confrontation, but also due to these errors, the jury was not provided a balanced understanding and perspective of the facts, testimony, and evidence in this case. The first primary issue that I would like to discuss is the testimony that was provided by an interviewing police officer. At trial, the interviewing police officer testified as to statements made by one of the state's witnesses in an extrajudicial setting, specifically identifying Mr. Mann as the witness, as the shooter in this case.
What's the standard of review for that issue?
That would be abuse of discretion.
Okay.
The reason that this is inadmissible hearsay is that this statement was made about a statement made by a declarant out of trial. And although this witness was brought before the court by the state did not question the witness at any point during direct examination about her identifying statements. Therefore, under Evidence Rule 611B, defense counsel was also unable to cross-examine the witness regarding these statements. And this goes against the confrontation clause, because later in the trial, the state called the interviewing police officer, who then brought up these statements. But this was at a point when cross-examining Ms. Seymour was no longer an option.
Is the confrontation clause problem the same as the evidentiary problem? In other words, an arguable violation of the evidentiary rules?
I would say that it is, because under Evidence Rule 801D13, it says that if there is a statement made out of trial that's brought in, there has to be an opportunity to cross-examine concerning the statement. And from the appellant's point of view, that's a very key part of that rule concerning the statement, because it means that not only is the witness brought before the court, but also the statement is brought up, and regardless of the witness's response, whether it is approval, you know, remembering her statement, denying her statement, or not having no recollection, it needs to be brought up so that at least the defense counsel can have the opportunity to cross-examine. And in this case, that did not occur.
Assume for purposes of the argument that the right to confrontation was violated. Even a constitutional violation is subject to a harmless error analysis. So can you address why the error was not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt based on the facts in this case?
A confrontation clause error is given a particular analysis, and it is, I think the Washington Supreme Court discussed this in Jasper, and the standard is that the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the error did not affect the verdict that was obtained.
And so how did the error affect the verdict obtained here?
I would argue that it affected the way that this verdict was obtained because of the importance of Ms. Seymour's testimony. Ms. Seymour was in a very unique stance in this case. There was two witnesses who identified Mr. Mann as the shooter. One of the witnesses was granted immunity by the state, and Ms. Mann was the only witness who essentially had no sort of question marks around her credibility. And she was also in a unique perspective. She was in the car from which the victim was shot. And her significance in this case, I don't think it can be just overemphasized. It's critical. And
what was the nature of the defense? Was it denial, or was it somebody else shot, or what was it?
At trial, what were the grounds for not allowing it into?
What was the defense that was offered? I mean, in evaluating whether it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, it's sometimes helpful to look at what the defendant argued to the jury.
At trial, Mr. Mann, he did not testify, but the argument, essentially what, I'm working off a limited fact pattern that doesn't really articulate a lot of the...
If I have asked you a question that's out of bounds, just say so, and we'll get to something that is...
Okay. just based off my reading of the fact pattern, there wasn't a lot of articulation about what the defense's arguments were in this case. But at least in regard to Ms. Seymour, her testimony as relayed through the testimony of the interviewing police officer was... It was critical. It was for the jury determination. Moving on to the next error, there was also prejudicial statements made by the state during closing arguments. And specifically, there was two, I view these prejudicial statements in two ways. There's the thing that really jumps out is the statement about, the defense counsel has been trying to trick you. And while this is improper and arguably prejudicial, the main prejudicial element of the statements by the state during rebuttal, in the appellant's point of view, were the state's testimony that the defense counsel had introduced new and unsupported facts. And as the fact pattern indicates, the defense did no such thing. The defense made inferences from the evidence, but the defense did not assert any new facts. And as this court has supported in the case of State v. Hale, as the Washington Supreme Court has also supported in State v. Perez Cervantes, and even the United States Supreme Court in New York v. Herring, the defense, especially in a criminal case and during closing argument, is allowed to make inferences from the fact and really draw conclusions from the fact, because for the defense in a criminal prosecution, this is the last attempt to really reach out to the jury. And solely based off the fact pattern, there was nothing that was done by the defense in this case that really stepped outside the bounds.
Did you object?
There was an objection that was made, and
did you ask for a curative instruction?
I believe we asked for mistrial. That was the objections request. Returning to this argument, it was prejudicial because it wasn't only talking about the character or personality or argument style of the defense counsel. It was making statements that were almost legal in nature, saying that the defense...
So are you taking the position that no curative instruction could have in any way addressed the prejudicial effect of the comments that were made by the prosecutor?
I would have to say that a curative instruction could potentially have mitigated the effects of the statements made by the prosecutor.
That's true. Why don't you lose because you didn't ask for one?
I'm not fully acquainted with the facts. Even though I don't think one was asked for, I think that a mistrial was asked for. And
that's what the statement says. It says that Mann objected to these remarks by the prosecutor and moved for a mistrial. And generally, if a court on appeal finds that a curative instruction would have ameliorated the error, then a mistrial is not appropriate relief. And if you don't ask for the curative instruction, then you don't have a basis for gaining relief in the appellate court. And that's why I asked the question.
I think the reason that a curative instruction wasn't asked for was that by that point in time, the injury had been done, and even a curative effect, especially at the end of a trial, wouldn't have remedied the damage that had already occurred. Thank you.
Okay, you have 1 minute for rebuttal.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Jonathan Collins, and I represent the State in this matter. Your Honors, the State asks that this Court uphold Mann's conviction for three reasons. The first is that the officer's testimony regarding Jane Seymour's prior statement identifying Mann as the shooter was properly admissible under Evidence Rule 801D13, and that even if that testimony was admitted in error, that such error was harmless. The second.
How do you get around the Confrontation Clause problem?
Your Honor, under State v. Grover, if testimony is properly admissible under 801D13, it is not hearsay, and therefore the Confrontation Clause does not apply.
Well, a Confrontation Clause is a constitutional principle as distinct from an evidentiary rule. So you're dealing with two different bases.
I agree, Your Honor. Nevertheless, this Court has specifically stated in Grover that testimony properly admitted under 801D13 does not violate the Confrontation Clause.
What is 801D13?
801D13 essentially allows a prior statement, testimony of a prior statement from a declarant witness to be admitted as long as that witness is subject to cross-examination during trial. So in this case, Jane Seymour had previously identified Mann as the shooter during an interview with police, and at trial, that police officer gave testimony as to those facts.
But the police officer wasn't the declarant.
Exactly. 801D3 allows a witness to testify that another witness previously identified someone after having perceived that person, as long as the declarant witness is present at trial and subject to cross-examination. So in this case, while the police officer was the witness, the declarant witness was Seymour, who was present at trial and subject to cross-examination.
Okay, you're relying on Grover, a case that was decided before Crawford and before the current construct for analyzing Confrontation Clause issues was developed by the U.S. Supreme Court. Do you have any authority post-Crawford that would have this hearsay rule, which focuses on the reliability of the statement and the opportunity to cross-examine, any authority that reaches the same result under the current Confrontation Clause analysis used by our U.S. Supreme Court?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, there is unpublished authority from this court that reaches the exact same result.
You don't get to tell us about unpublished authority, as you know, from the rules. And you can get in trouble for trying to do that. So do you have anything that would allow you to discuss in front of us that uses the Crawford construct and reaches the analysis under the hearsay rule that you are urging on us?
I don't have any authority that is published that relies on Grover that specifically reaches this exact point. But I would like to move on and simply say that this court has essentially time and again relied on Grover for this purpose. And I would go further to say that even if this was a hearsay violation, as Judge Schindler noted during appellant's argument, that error is still subject to a harmless error analysis. And under the constitutional harmless error analysis, as the Washington State Supreme Court stated in State v. Smith, we have to show that it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, and the conviction will only be reversed as long as there's any reasonable possibility that the evidence was necessary. And I think that in this case, it's clear that the evidence was not necessary. In this trial, there were four people who testified. You had Rogers, who testified that Mann was in the back seat and that the gun was in the back seat. You had Rome, who was sitting in the passenger seat and actually specifically identified Mann as the shooter. You had Seymour, who was in the other car, the car that was being shot at. And Seymour testified that she saw the shooter sitting in the back seat, or rather, she saw the gun through the window of the back seat of Rogers' car. And you had the officer, who testified that Seymour identified Mann as the shooter. So if appellant is correct and that the officer's testimony was not properly admitted under Evidence Rule 801 and violated the Confrontation Clause, it's nevertheless harmless because the officer's testimony is essentially redundant with Rome's. Rome also identified Mann as the shooter.
How do you respond to the argument that Seymour's kind of a clean witness, whereas Rome's really a dirty witness because of the immunity issue?
Your Honor, I would say that regardless of that fact, the defense presented no other evidence at trial. Mann didn't testify. Even though
the defendant doesn't have any obligation to present evidence Would the state's case be weaker if the only evidence it had regarding the identity of the shooter was someone that made a deal and bought his freedom with testimony?
The state's case would be weaker, Your Honor. However, that's not the analysis as the Washington State Supreme Court is under State v. Smith. It's not simply would the state's case be weaker. The analysis is if that testimony was actually necessary to get the conviction, if there's a reasonable possibility that it was necessary. And I think that under State v. Smith, there isn't a reasonable possibility that that was necessary since that testimony was essentially redundant with Rome's. And all of the other testimony at trial suggested that the shooter was in the back seat of the car, and we know from everyone else's testimony that the person sitting in the back seat was a man.
And do we know that the only person sitting in the back seat was a man?
That's true. All the testimony corroborates that fact. In fact, in appellate's brief, they point to the Delaware factors from the United States Supreme Court, and in analyzing whether there's constitutional error, they look to things like whether the evidence is cumulative, whether there's corroborating evidence, and the extent of cross-examination otherwise permitted. And I think that that's all present in this case. The officer's testimony was cumulative with Mann's. There's also a lot of other testimony that corroborates the officer's testimony that Mann was the shooter. And Jane Seymour was subject to a lot of cross-examination, in fact, extensive examination even outside the presence of the jury. But with the court's permission, I would like to move on to my second point, which is that any improper statements made by the prosecutor during closing argument did not cause prejudice to the defendant. Under State v. Thorgerson for a few reasons. The first is, as I've already been discussing, there was a tremendous amount of evidence indicating that Mann is guilty. And in the circumstances of the trial, the statements at issue, which did not go to any of the credibility of the witnesses, they did not specifically draw improper inferences from the evidence, they merely sort of in passing characterized the defense as a trick.
So your position is that the statements were not improper at all?
No, we can see that they were improper.
Okay, so the question is the prejudicial effect.
Exactly, and exactly, Your Honor. And I think under State v. Thorgerson, they certainly were not. And I think the facts in Thorgerson are important here. The prosecutor in Thorgerson committed violations that were far more egregious than what happened in this case. The prosecutor not only described the defense as bogus, they made improper statements about witness credibility, they brought up out-of-court statements made by witnesses. In fact, the prosecutor in Thorgerson tried to revive evidence that the judge in that case had specifically already struck from the record. And the Washington State Supreme Court in Thorgerson still said that that did not prejudice the defendant, given the evidence that was against the defendant in that case, which was, like this case, essentially eyewitness testimony. The appellant in this case needs to show that there's a substantial likelihood that these statements made by the prosecutor improperly influenced the jury. And I think given in light of the standards set forward in Thorgerson and the weight of the evidence in this case, that substantial likelihood perhaps isn't there. Obviously, would it have been better if the prosecutor hadn't said those things? I would probably say that's true. But given the circumstances of the trial as a whole, I don't think there's a substantial likelihood that those statements so improperly influenced the jury's verdict that it warrants a reversal. Lastly, Your Honors, I would like to talk about my final point, which is that the trial court did not abuse its discretion when it excluded evidence of Rome's prior juvenile convictions. In State v. Girard, this court made very clear that when you're trying to introduce prior evidence of a witness's juvenile convictions, it places a heavy burden on the defendant, requiring a positive showing that the prior juvenile convictions are necessary to determine the guilt of the defendant. And the court is very clear that you need to give reasons that are more than just general impeachment. You can't just say, we want to put this in because we need to impeach the credibility of this witness. And in this case, the defense did not provide any additional reasons other than general impeachment purposes. They tried to argue that this is a really important state witness, but with all due respect, all state witnesses are important state witnesses. And they only wanted to introduce these prior convictions to essentially demonstrate that Rome was untrustworthy, which under Girard, they clearly need to make a showing more than that in order to introduce evidence of prior convictions. And I would just want to emphasize that the whether to exclude or admit that evidence is subject to an abuse of discretion standard. And as this court, as the Washington State Supreme Court said in Davidson v. Seattle, that if whether to admit or exclude evidence is fairly debatable on either side, that under abuse of discretion, it's proper to simply to defer to the trial court. And with that, Your Honors, I'd like to conclude and say thank you for your time, and we ask that you uphold Mann's conviction. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Your Honors, I would just like to reiterate one more time that Evidence Rule 801D13.
I looked. It has to do with identification,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Yes, it does. But one of the key things about it is that the witness must not only be available for cross-examination, but cross-examination concerning the statement. And that didn't occur here, and that is the main...
Couldn't your client's counsel at trial have asked this witness questions about that, but strategically determined not to because perhaps no evidence was going to come in of identification of your client because perhaps the prosecutor made a mistake?
Yes, but I think but the fact that it was brought in at a later point in the and there was no further opportunity to cross-examine.
Is there anything in the rule that describes the order in which the witnesses testify or only requires that the person be available for cross-examination on the subject?
You may answer.
I think that the rules indicate that in order for that testimony to be admissible, there must be an opportunity to cross-examine concerning that statement. And in this trial, there was no such opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you.